I'm Lieutenant Joe Pangaro. I've been a cop for 27 years. I like to say I got a backstage pass to life. Well, guess what? I got some tickets for you. So come on in, pull up a chair, turn up that volume, and let's go. Chasing Justice is on.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to Chasing Justice. I'm your host, Lieutenant Joe Pangaro, and we have a full boat today. So we're going to go over some of the topical things of the world. You know, of course, we have to talk about the COVID-19 and what's going on, where we are. There's a lot brewing now, right? We're talking about trying to find a way to reopen the world or not reopen the world, especially here in America, as the economy continues to take a hit. I guess a question we all have to ask ourselves, is this real? Now, we know the virus is real, and we know that if certain people get the virus, they could die. That's a reality. We know that the numbers are high. I have some statistics I'm going to throw out in a second. But we also know that our economy is taking a big blast. And this could be just as deadly, if not worse, than what we're doing for the lockdown. So, as I scroll through my pages of outrages here, normally I like to have these things printed out, but I like to go through them and see them live as we see what's happening. So we're going to cover some of these things. Some events going on across our country. In a little bit, we're going to talk to Fire Chief John Sahachin. John is an excellent young man who is currently the owner of Jersey Shore Emergency Training. And John really has hit on a high note for our for classes for that need to be taught for our first responders. Now, he comes out of the fire service world, but he was also a police dispatcher, and now he's a master trainer, and his program is really amazing. It started out with understanding the pain that sometimes first responders go through by living through some of the events they do. I asked John to come on. He'll be here in segment two with us today to talk about his class and what he sees going on in the light of all the pain we see all these first responders potentially going through. I mean, they're out there working in the streets every day, when most of us are home trying to, you know, quarantine and be safe, and they're out there dealing with people every single day. So we'll have John in a little bit. And then in segment three today, we're going to bring in the lovely and talented Miss Kathy Pangaro, and we'll talk about some of the things that she sees going on out in the world. So this is going to be a bang-up show today. So here's my question about the COVID-19 shutdown. Let's start there, because that's still affecting all of our lives. Upfront and personal. How long do we protect ourselves from the virus while inviting economic destruction? Now, that's a question each and every one of us is going to have to answer sooner rather than later, I think, because the trouble we're seeing in the economy is building every day. Isn't it amazing, though, that we could shut down for 2 months? And for the most part, the country can go on. If it goes longer than this, you might see, this is where you're going to see the loss of businesses that will never come back. And as it is already, there are many businesses who will probably not be able to come back, which is devastating to those people. There's a comedian out there that I've seen a couple times, Vic DiBenedetto. He's a New Jersey guy. And Vic's big shtick is that he gets a point of view and he really goes at it. So if you have a chance to see him on Facebook or something, really funny guy. And if he comes live, you would enjoy him. But I saw him the other day. He was doing a bit on one of the social medias. And he was talking to the politicians saying, you know, what are you doing? You know, you told us all to go home, to stay home and do the right thing. And we did. For the most part, everybody went home and lost their jobs doing the right thing. And you guys all said you would help. When he says you guys, what he's talking about is the government. You would help us. You know, people still have to pay mortgages. They got to pay their rent. They got to pay everything. And Vic's point, as funny in the funny way that he put it in his rant, was that we're giving people $1,200, maybe $2,400 for a couple. All right, so that $2,400 one time, what's that going to cover? We're shut down for 3 months. That's going to cover what? Maybe the mortgage payment. Not much other than mortgage, some food for a couple of weeks. What do you do the other couple of months? Right? So he wanted to know, how come we're not seeing something like some kind of government law that says to all these financial institutions, listen, You got billions of dollars. Now, I'm not one to say somebody has something, you take it from them. So I'm not saying take it from them. But how about we say, okay, here's the problem. All these mortgages get an immediate 6-month addition at the end of the mortgage. So you get 6 months, you don't have to pay your mortgage. You start up again in 6 months. But at the end of the loan, you'll tack it on. And I said, you know what, Vic, that's not a horrible idea. That is asking a lot of mortgage companies, though, and banks to do that. I mean, they're private institutions. We all took our mortgages, right? We didn't ask them to put anything in the contract that said, hey, in case there's a big shutdown or I lose my job, can I not pay my mortgage and still keep my house? So that's a reality. We didn't do that. You know, none of us really considered that at the time. But this is a special circumstance, isn't it? Isn't this a time where we look and say, okay, everyone has to do the right thing. Maybe we should have conversations with these banking people. Maybe we should have conversations with these insurance companies and say, okay, if you're on the brink of going bankrupt as an insurance company, maybe you can't afford to do anything. But if you're not, what is it you can do to help the people that keep you in business, right? We're all trying to do something. We're all staying home so that people can stay healthy. Well, what can everybody do? I'm not saying make it mandatory. I'm not saying that at all. I'm not a mandatory kind of person like that. But I think it's a conversation we need to have because Vic's right. You know, $1,200 or $2,400, how long is that really going to help people for, right? If they just pay their mortgage and a couple of their bills, it doesn't leave you a lot, and you're going to be stuck for the rest of that money as you go down the road. So that's it. So what could be worse? Protecting ourselves from the virus, looking at the flattened curve now. The curve has flattened in the New York, New Jersey area, which is really the indicator, the chief indicator they were looking for, that if we can flatten that curve, which is why we're all staying home, we would be able to restart our economy at some point. So if we're going to restart our economy, do we wait for the whole country to flatten the curve? Because it's moving. You know, the bug is moving now from one part of the country to another. And while admittedly everywhere else is not as populated as the New York, New Jersey area, which is why we had such a big outbreak. But the reality is it's going to move across the country. Do we wait for everyone to have the same flattened curve, so to speak? Or do we say we'll start moving in and you do it? So one of the questions that comes up is whether or not your state is going to return to normal is dependent on the political structure in your state. So if you have a Democratic governor, you're probably going to be shut down longer than anywhere else. If you have a Republican governor, they're probably looking to, I don't know, revamp everything and get everyone back to work sooner rather than later. And that means kind of taking a chance, right? So we have to ask ourselves, where do we need to be? This is a clear discussion we need to have because hard decisions have to be made. This is not really one way or another at this point. I guess a lot of people could argue that in a regular flu season, where we know, we've said this how many times, between 30 and 80,000 Americans die every year from the regular flu. Right now, I think they're saying we've had 26 or 27,000 people die of this COVID, and I could have that number wrong. I'm going to have to look for that right number. But that's just for this last couple of months, which is horrible to the people and their families who've had that. But we're going to have to deal with this. I mean, what do we do next flu season? Well, the regular flu is okay to kill 80,000 people, and we'll just stay open. But this COVID thing, boy, what if that comes back? What if when the next thing comes up? The mouse flu. Right? What if the mouse flu comes up and is going to get us? Or it's not bats next time that ends up passing some disease. What if it's the polar bear flu or whatever comes next? Do we shut down again? Does this become part of what we do every flu season as these things come around? We shut the country down. And that's what I mean. We're going to have to make hard decisions here. How many people is acceptable to die to keep the economy going? Boy, now there's a tough question for you, right? Gee, Lieutenant Joe, what the hell are you talking about? So are you prepared to make a decision like that to say, okay, we know regular flu, 30 to 80,000 people die every year. Should we shut down every flu season now and flatten that curve right away? Like maybe we shut down from October through February every year. Is that the right thing to do? We'd probably save a lot of those 30,000 to 80,000 lives if we did that. But are we going to do it? We don't even give it a thought. We don't even give it a second thought. We're not going to shut down for that. But we shut down for COVID-19. Are we going to shut down again next year if COVID pops back up? Because these things don't go away completely. They dissipate. They back down. They go into remission for a while. And it's a lot of it's weather dependent with flus and viruses. And this is what I'm saying when I say we have to make some tough decisions. We have to decide. And if we can't talk about it, because, you know, the name calling comes out immediately. You know, I think President Trump said something about, you know, about the number of people are going to die if we go back, if we start the world up again. And immediately, he doesn't care about people's lives. He just wants money. He's just worried about money. Well, if you're going to take an opinion like that, you have to ask yourself a lot of questions. Does money not matter? And I don't mean in the get yourself to heaven kind of way, right? Where you should be worried about the poor and you should be worried about doing the right thing and not so much about money. I'm talking about the everyday thing, like where you pay your mortgage or they throw you out of your house with your kids, where you go to the grocery store and you buy groceries and toilet paper when there is any, so that you can actually have food in your house. Because you can't just go in there and go, hey, I'm Lieutenant Joe. I'm a good looking guy. Can I have a truckload of food? They don't give it to you. You know, your car. Don't pay your car for a few months and you'll be walking or riding a bicycle. So some of these things are absolutely real. How long do we go? So as many of you know, when I pose a question, there's also usually many tentacles to the question. Because all I ask you to do is to think. I don't want to think for you. But I want to present some of these ideas because this is what rolls around in my head when I sit there and thinking about this. I noticed on social media, there's a lot of people opining, commenting, ranting, being upset over the perceived situation that maybe this is a setup. Maybe we're being set up for a couple of reasons. Number one, to drive us closer to socialism. And anyone who says that that's not a real goal of our friends in the Democrat Party is not really got their eyeballs open. The guy that just almost won their primary, if they didn't cheat him out of it, was a socialist. Right, so they definitely want to go that way. They're just not ready to go that way fully right now because they know it doesn't look good. The other thing is this an attempt to destroy the economy to hurt President Trump? Because everything is focused now on the election. The whole world is focused on this election. And they have tried everything. They've thrown everything at this guy, including the kitchen sink. They've impeached him. They've accused him of all kinds of stuff. And nothing has worked. Because for the most part, even though you don't like the things he says, you don't like the tone of his voice, you don't like the way he talks to the reporters, the country is stronger. We are in a better position, and our economy was roaring until COVID-19 came along. So is this something that is a political setup? And again, it comes down to your governor, right? What did I just say? If your governor is a Republican, they're looking to open your state up and take a chance that the economy can come back. And yes, some people are going to get sick. If you have a Democrat governor, they are looking to hold back and keep everybody home, find a way to keep paying you money so you stay home and kind of get used to letting the economy drift down into nothing. We're getting close now to 20% unemployment, which is Great Depression era unemployment. Now, you say to yourself, is it legitimate 20% unemployment? And I don't mean the number of people. This is a manufactured situation that happened. Whether it was done purposely to damage Trump and his economy or the economy in general at all, this was manufactured. We came up with this and said, here's our answer. We're going to shut down. Everybody goes home, no work. So even if it was for a health reason, for the right reason, and not the conspiracy reason, it was still concocted and took place. If this were to go away tomorrow, would we recover from that? Well, I think we would. I think the fundamentals of the economy are there. The desire to work is there. The benefits of everybody working were clear to everyone just a month and a half ago. I think they come back. So then you have to say to yourself, okay, so what evidence would there be for either one of these possible scenarios? It's for health reasons, and that's how it came across initially at first. But if we remember all the news, didn't we hear that There was nothing to this. January, even parts of February, there was nothing to this. This is it's just a flu. It's no big deal. And then President Trump shut down travel from China, and he's a xenophobe. He's a hater. He's a racist. Go to Chinatown. Go to their celebrations. Go have parties. Everybody's American. Let's have fun together, right? We don't have to listen to evil Trump. And then just not a couple weeks later, as the virus started to spread and people started to die, then suddenly the whole tone changed on the thing that he didn't act fast enough. No, you were just telling everybody to go out. He was telling us to shut down travel. This is a whole new world. All right, so where could the evidence be? Well, I think the biggest evidence is the differences in what your governor is. If your governor is a Republican, they're looking to open. If it's a Democrat, they're looking to stay shut. And you'd have to say, is there political reasons for that? And I'm not gonna sit here and tell you, well, I think, because I'm a conservative, that I think conservatives always do the right thing. No, but I think they do want people to get back to work. That's what we all want, right? We want a thriving economy so we can all do better. I want my kids to do better, have great lives. Our friends on the left, though, they have that other agenda. They do have that other agenda. They want us to go socialist. They want more people dependent on the government. They want to solve the problems by printing money and handing it out, taxing the rich, confiscating, redistributing wealth. See, these are not just words. These are real things in life when you see them actually take place. And we're seeing that take place now. Cory Booker is a senator from my state here in New Jersey. And the other day, I saw him come out with a couple other people in his party, and they said, we have an idea. We think every American should get a $2,000 a month check, and we should suspend rent and mortgages. Now, I don't know the exact amount of time, but I know it wasn't a month he was talking about. So basically, he's saying, hey, everybody likes staying home, right? You having a good time staying home? We'll give you $2,000 a month and no rent or mortgage payment. Sounds pretty good, right? Now, of course, that would kind of insinuate that the restrictions would be lifted. So we could go to the parks, we could do things, but we have to be real careful. So we got to stay 6 feet apart. We're going to keep wearing these masks, but we can go out now. And we're going to give you the money to go out. And we'll redistribute that money. We'll go find it. We'll tax people. We'll take it, whatever. But you can stay home. Now, is there a lot of people that would prefer to just stay home at this point? That would say, I kind of like this not going to work thing, and they're going to give me a check. I mean, we see how many people now are really looking for their checks. They're trying to find those checks. They're very upset that they don't have those checks because the government, of course, screwed up sending out checks. Now, how difficult could it be? You look on the tax rolls, you find somebody's name, their social security number, their address, you send them a check. Well, obviously, I know it's more complicated than that, but they seem to be able to do it, right? They can process all these tax forms when we have to pay. Why can't they get that information and send out the checks? Lots of interesting questions here, ladies and gentlemen. This is what I'm talking about. So as we move forward here on Chasing Justice, we're going to continue to answer these questions and many others. But up next will be Chief John Sahachin, Fire Chief John Sahachin, to talk to us a little bit about what goes on with first responders and the potential difficulties of being a first responder. So stay right there. We'll be back in a minute with Chasing Justice here on the America Out Loud Radio Network.
Think back to the last time you felt healthy and energized. The best times of our lives occur when we're at the peak of our health, sleeping better, full of energy and focus. We know that fades with age, and you might be feeling the effects of aging as low energy and poor sleep. But it doesn't have to be that way. There haven't been any nutrition systems designed to rejuvenate our bodies as we get older, until now. Healthy Cell Pro is the only multi-nutrient system that impacts the building block of your body, the cell. Created by anti-aging expert and Nobel Prize nominee, Dr. Vincent Giampapa, award-winning Healthy Cell Pro cuts through the complexity of nutrition supplements by simply giving you the purest ingredients, filling dietary gaps to nourish your cells and enhance your quality of life for optimal performance. Visit HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount or call 844-869-9958.
Welcome back, everybody, to Chasing Justice. I'm your host, Lieutenant Joe Pangaro. And in this segment, I have a very special guest, a young man who I met when he was a little bit younger in law enforcement. He was working in our police department. He'll tell you all about that. But over the course of time, he has turned into a tremendous trainer and a advocate for first responders everywhere. And that's my guest, Mr. John Shahachin. John, how are you?
Yes, sir. Great. Thank you for having me. It's an honor to be back with you.
Absolutely great, John. So listen, we have lots of people out here who love first responders, especially during this crisis. Everybody is really respecting us again, kind of a lot like 9/11 when they realize the value of what we have. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your career, where you come from, and what you're all about?
Sure. Well, I lived in Wall Township my entire life, born and raised. I started my law enforcement career right out of high school in Ocean Township with Lieutenant Joe Pangaro there, the famous. And learned a lot in Ocean Township. It was a busy town, a very squared away agency. And I remember the midnight shifts talking with Joe, you know, about learning everything, the interviews, crimes, and I loved every minute of it. So I then went on to Wall Township to be a dispatcher, where I was for about 12, 13 years. I just recently got a job in Toms River Township as the police or the fire and EMS communication supervisor. So with that, I've been a fire instructor on the side, volunteer firefighter. I teach at the local fire academy, and I just started my own business about 2 years ago, Jersey Shore Emergency Training. So we focus on first responder training, dispatcher training, fire, EMS, police, everything.
That's outstanding, John. And like I said, I remember when you first came on and you were one of these guys, you know, we talk about it in law enforcement when the rookies come on, you know, you get different kinds of people. Somebody that comes on and they keep their mouth shut and they learn. Other guys and girls come on and they think they know everything, and it really retards their ability to learn the job because they're busy running their mouth constantly. but it's your development has been really interesting to me as a trainer and as someone who has had a business for training for many years. To watch you come along has been great. So I'm telling everybody out there, you know, Jersey Shore Emergency Training. We're going to get you a website. We're going to get you all of that in a little bit to look it up. So if you have somebody in your family who's a first responder, law enforcement, EMT, fire department, you really want to listen closely to what John's talking about, because I know that some of the courses that he's teaching are not just about, you know, and I'm going to put this in layman's terms here, John, you know, not about putting out a fire, just like my course is not about locking up a bad guy. Some of the most important courses we have are about how to survive in this career. First responders' careers are not easy. They are filled with pain. They are filled with all kinds of things that stay with you for the rest of your life. And we've talked about this, you and I, offline many times. Yep. The pain of being a first responder and the seeing the terrible things that you see can lead to destruction of people. So
absolutely.
I know you have a story there, and whatever you're willing to share with us, I think people...
Sure. So I'll share a little bit with you. My course that I do is I teach for the Division of Fire and Safety. It's a mental health seminar. So it's an 8-hour course. So I won't take 8 hours of your time, but I'll synopsize it for you. Basically, I went through a couple of incidents. I was chief of my volunteer department for 8 years straight. Went through a couple of relationships, went through some health issues, and a couple of incidents that really took a toll on my mindset and my body. And what I learned from that going forward is that I call it the bucket effect. Everybody's born with a bucket, right? You put finance in there, you put all your stressors in there that we have to deal with on a regular life. And then being a first responder, you have all these other stressors that come into it. You know, seeing the terrible things we see, dealing with your coworkers that you have to, you know, trust your life with. All of these problems that you add into that bucket, if you don't have an outlet for that, some way of getting rid of that, whether it's talking to somebody or understanding how you process an incident, is very important also to the bucket effect. Because if you poorly process an incident, I'm sure you know, that could put you over the edge. And we've seen it more and more, unfortunately, with the suicides in police and fire.
Absolutely. So what John is actually talking about is, and anybody out there, and I know there's a lot of first responders out there, a lot of my brothers and sisters listening in, we all know what it's like. You know, when you see, I've likened what some of the things that we see, the painful stuff, the horrible things people do to each other, the terrible tragedies we see, you know, and the fire service, you know, you see people who die in a fire, you see little children who die in a fire, elderly people. And, you know, it's part of the job, and all first responders, they work their way through it. But the reality is every one of those things leaves a seed inside of you that can grow like a cancer. And if you don't deal with those things up front, if you do not face them, what happens is over the course of time, it is like a cancer and it grows you. And that's why so many first responders kill themselves. You know, it's not because they were weak-minded people. It's just that that constant buildup of that stress can lead you to a position of hopelessness or whatever, and people take their lives. And we know that that absolutely happens. So one of the things, John, if you've ever seen a meme on social media, and it shows you, I think it's a firefighter who's also an EMT, and he's sitting in back of the ambulance, and all around him is the ghosts of people that he's had to deal with.
Yep. You know? I think it's funny that you said just before, you know, all of these things in your career when you're younger. And it's funny that we're talking about this now, because when I was dispatching and you were the patrol lieutenant, I was 21 years old. You know, I didn't know anything. I didn't know what was going on. You know, I'm 35 now, and I know I have anxiety, and I know I have bad days. And all of that in the last however many years that is, 14, 15 years, like you said, I didn't know how to process things. I didn't know what was going on, you know, and that happens so much in our field that people just don't process things properly. Or know how to, that they need to talk about things.
And what we always do is we fall back on this gallows humor where you make a joke out of something horrible because that's the best way you can process it. Right. I mean, I remember as a young cop going on a job and seeing, you know, I could deal with people beating the heck out of each other, even if it's, you know, wrong, but they beat the hell out of each other. And to see a little child brutalized, a completely innocent little child, and it's shocking to think, because I would never, ever think to do a thing like that to a little child. But here you have someone who brutalizes a child and they don't think twice about it. And then you see the effects it has on this kid. And then sometimes there's nothing you can do about it. I mean, the best you can is help that kid at that moment. And then the court gives the child back to these people. And then you get another call. And I've been to them where we've been to the house how many times, and then the kid ends up killed, dead. Right. Right? Can you imagine what the DIFAS workers, the Division of Family and Youth, the family services people have to go through? The trauma that they must have to go through is absolutely crazy. So pay attention to your first responders out there. When you see the cops, when you see the firemen, the EMTs, hey, say, hey, thank you. I appreciate what you do. That's a really important thing to do because it gives validation to what they're out there doing right now. You know, John, you want to talk a little bit about the stigma of not being able to openly discuss this stress and effects.
Yeah, what it goes right along with one, not knowing that we have all this, you know, and all this stuff builds up on us. But then what if we do realize that it builds up, like you just said, and we realize that something happens or we're not dealing with it well, who do we go to? Where do we go? And why, you know, it's all of a sudden you're an outcast. You're too weak, you know, or maybe this isn't the job for you. You hear all of those such negative things. That it's just not the case anymore. You know, we have to understand that we it's okay to go talk to somebody for help. You know, give that stress to somebody else. You know, that's okay. You know, you have to unload that stuff. Yeah. And if you just try to keep it all in, it's going to destroy you.
Absolutely. And I know more and more agencies at the end of my career, I know for the last bunch of years in my career, there was a movement towards recognizing that these traumas, that's what they are, they're traumas. And these traumas cannot just be allowed to fester. And you saw more and more agencies having a mandatory debriefing with a psychologist after a major incident, whether that's a major car accident where people are killed, because some of those are disgusting and horrible to see people in that condition, or a homicide or a severe, whatever it is, whatever could be traumatic, they would make you sit down with the psychologist and just talk it out. And for me, it was shocking. I remember it was a pretty high profile homicide we had where two people were killed, a woman in her 30s and an 88-year-old woman. And the grandson of the 80-year-old woman killed his girlfriend, and then he killed his grandmother, and he cut their heads, their hands and their feet off in an attempt to fake up the crime scene to look like a mob hit or something or other. And I was the lead detective on that. And it was shocking to see the things I saw in that house. It was bizarre what he did with the victims as he did this. But I know we had that in place. That was probably one of the most first ones we had where we all had to sit around. Here's these salty old dog cops that have been there forever. Right. you know, the supervisors, and we had two psychologists there. And I got to say, I was pretty well adjusted for that because I've always recognized I'm not taking these ghosts home with me. I always talked about it. But I remember sitting around and we were going around, and it was one salty old dog, and he's sitting there and he's making jokes. And you could see pretty clear it was stress for him, what he saw. And then finally somebody said, you know, it was pretty weird to see their heads cut off. That kind of bothered me a little. And then this guy opened up and talked about how much it bothered. Then he talked about a car accident he had 20 years earlier where he saw a little child killed. And this all came pouring out. And you realize if we don't do this, these statistics of us hurting ourselves is only going to continue.
Absolutely. And I love that you said the old salty dogs, because I was that guy. I was that fire chief, the fire instructor. I was that salty fireman, big bad fireman that I don't cry, I don't show emotion. You know, I finally found a good therapist, and she had me crying the second session. And I didn't even know what I was crying about, but I was just unloading 15 or 20 years of dead bodies and stress, you know, just stress.
Right. And I got to tell you, John, probably for a lot of people out there, it's shocking to hear you say that, because men don't cry, first of all.
Right.
And first responders, cops and firemen, if we don't cry, we get over everything. But I think just like you and me know, and so does everyone else who's listening, who's been in that position, you want to get it out of you. You feel that emotion and you stuff it down, you stuff it down, you stuff it down. And that's the cancer I'm talking about. That doesn't go away. Those people live with you. They come up later in your life when you see your own kids. And now you imagine, oh my gosh, that's like that little kid that had this or that or the other thing. So I'm really glad to hear you say that. And you're not ashamed of that at all.
No, I used to be. I used to be 100%. But now I know, you know, and she even told me, my grandfather grew up and he told me, you don't show people your emotions. You don't show them when you're too happy, or you don't show them when you're too sad. And that's, especially being fire chief. I mean, you got to put on the face. You were a lieutenant, you know, you got to put the face on, you got to put the game face on. But where does all that stress go? And it builds up. And the term cancer that you use, that's exactly what it is. Cause once it takes over your body, there might not be any coming back from it.
Yep. Now, and I got to tell you, for the people who listen in here on Chasing Justice, and for everybody on the AmericaOutloud.com platform that I'm so grateful that you read my columns. I had one up a couple years ago, which was the first one I ever wrote. And it really was a result of seeing someone I know, or knowing someone who killed themselves, a police officer I grew up with. I didn't ever imagine this person would kill themselves. And he did. And it struck me. I said, wait a minute, what are we doing here? Why would this guy kill himself? I mean, he was at a high ranking position, smaller town, but still. And he was the bee's knees, as they used to say. He had the world under his control. It was beautiful. And he ended up killing himself. And that shocked me. Shortly thereafter, another guy I didn't know so well in a neighboring town, same kind of a situation, very cool guy, good cop, really a nice fella, ended up killing himself because of stress. And I said, wait a minute. There has to be something here, there's some reason. And I started to research this a little bit, and I wrote this article. It was published in the FBI magazine, and it's called The Tragic Toll of Police Work. Now, I think I put it up on the platform once. I'm not sure if I did or not. I'll look. If it's never been there before, I'll have them put it up on the platform. And basically, it describes my process through this of understanding how we have got to open this up and get it out there, because we're going to be saving people. We're saving ourselves. And why we do these things, you know, the pain, we have to get that out there. And when you started doing your program, I was just so thrilled to see, because I didn't realize fire guys went through the same things. You know, you guys are, you know, fire guys, you know, you guys are excellent. You show up at the fire, hey, you run into flames, you put out the fire, right?
Yeah.
But you also see some terrible things, experience some terrible things. And I didn't realize that was happening to you too. And I think that's why you and I later here in life as trainers really
took it off. And interesting that you mentioned about your article. That was your first article you wrote for that piece. And I'm not a writer by any means, but my first thing I ever wrote was a featured article in Fire Engineering. And it was about mental health. And it took, I mean, I got thousands and thousands of views and emails. And it was exactly what yours. It was how I deal with it, my story a little bit, and how I deal with it. And like, what are we doing here? something's wrong here, you know? And now you see it all over social media, mental health, and, you know, and I'm glad, that's great. But it was almost like, what are we doing here? You know, something's wrong.
Something's wrong. And that's what I said. I think I see the tide turning, is that we're starting to recognize that as we get the younger crowd takes over in these positions, they've grown up with this as kids. You know, you're in school and everyone talks about their feelings as opposed to the way it used to be. And I don't mean to make fun of that, but and sometimes we go too far, you know, with,
yeah, right.
But the reality is we have to be able to talk about these kind of things, because that's what's going to lead to healing. And that's what we want. You want to come out of your career. If you have a son or a daughter or a wife or somebody, your husband's in law enforcement or fire service, you want them come out of that career thrilled that they gave community service for all these years. They did some good things, and that those ghosts do not haunt them. Because I know some people, those ghosts haunt them really bad, and I feel terrible for them, but no one was ever there to help them. So you're right. Doing a tremendous service, John, for everybody that's on the job now, no matter what they do as first responders. It's really great. So I'm glad, glad to have you here. If people wanted to reach out to you, how can they get in touch with you, John Sahatchin?
Sure. So my website is jerseyshoreemergencytraining.com. Same email, jerseyshoreemergencytraining@gmail.com. And it has, I put all my personal contact information there. And my cell phone's on there, the email, Facebook, Instagram, everything. I'm all over social media. And I open the door to, if you ever need anything, and I'm no professional, I'm no trained professional. If you ever need anything, 100% any time of the day, reach out to me. And I've had people do it. And I'm completely honored that they do that. And all I do is I'm an ear for you. You know, I've been there. I know what you're feeling. If you're on the edge, you know, thinking about suicide, thinking about all these terrible thoughts in your head, before you do anything crazy, reach out to me. I'm sure Lieutenant Pangaro, you know, you could reach out to any of the guys who are really one of the guys. Don't be shy to reach out. I just don't understand how it gets to the point of not being able to, like, text your friend.
Right.
And, you know, and that's really what troubles me. Just, like, if I was going through these terrible thoughts, just text your friends. Hey, dude, we got to get together, you know.
I need some help, right?
Yeah.
Give that address again real slow so people can copy it.
Sorry. JerseyShoreEmergencyTraining.com.
JerseyShoreEmergencyTraining.com. Chief John Sahatchin.
Yes, sir.
You know, John, this segment went really very fast. It's an important topic, and I think we have so much more to cover. I mean, we were going to talk about training and everything else. would you come back on the show with us again?
Because I absolutely would be honored, and especially being with you, you know. Couldn't be in a better company.
Ha, that's very nice of you to say. Mrs. Lieutenant Joe probably agrees with you most of the time. John, thank you very much. I appreciate you being here. And we will have you back, because this conversation is just starting. So
great.
Listen, Chasing Justice Land, if you got somebody in the family who's a first responder, all right, make sure you get them to listen to the show, find it on podcast, get John's address if you need anything, and reach out to him. This is Lieutenant Joe for Chasing Justice, and we'll be back in a minute.
AmericaOutloud.com is the voice of liberty and justice for all. Well, as we celebrate our 4-year anniversary, thank you for making it all possible. We are a grassroots movement of patriots, blogs, podcasts, video, and 24/7 talk radio on our free apps on Apple, Android, or Alexa. We are the vision of the voices, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Alrighty, righty, righty. That's kind of my play on Matthew McConaughey's All Right, All Right, All Right. So I have to do it unique. This is Lieutenant Joe here on Chasing Justice. And with me today is Kathleen Pangaro, a person in which I have entrusted my entire life. And I have great confidence in everything she does. She's really a brilliant woman. And I'm very lucky that, first of all, she's also beautiful. And she's my wife. So, Kathleen, welcome aboard.
Hi, Joe.
Thanks for being here. You know, that John Sahatchin was really amazing, wasn't he? I mean, this guy trying to help people. I thought it was great to talk to him. He was an awesome guy.
He always has been.
And he's trying to do the right thing all the time. All right, so here we're going to try and pick up where I kind of left off in segment one. I was trying to talk about, is this real? You know, in the meantime, I was getting some tweets from friends of mine who know what I'm talking about today. And they're saying, well, it seems like it was done for the right reason. We did the shutdown to protect everyone's health. And my question was, has it now morphed into a political thing where if you have a conservative governor, a Republican governor, they're looking to open. If you have a Democrat governor, they're looking to shut us down. And I heard some interesting stuff. I want to read something to you here. I got some quotes here because quotes are always helpful. Liz Peek, she's a Fox News writer on the Fox News channel. And she had a little column that I pulled some quotes out of it. Adam Schiff recently, we remember Adam Schiff, right? Mr. I have all the evidence on Trump that never appeared. He tweeted this recently. There's no way to safely reopen without massive testing. Yet we're barely testing more people this week than last. If Trump ignores the experts and forces a premature reopening, even more Americans will die. I get it. So not enough testing. What that means is it's not safe to reopen. So more people will die and it will be Trump's fault. That's kind of her point, is that this is what they're setting up, this barrier that Trump wants to open. He don't care about people. And they're saying, well, if people die, it's on him. So don't do it too quick. Right? Why don't they want to open? Meanwhile, Dr. Fauci, you know, Dr. Fauci, who's argues with the president every other day. You don't really know where he's coming from. He was really slow on the uptick. He's one of the people who told us in January, you know, not a big deal. Don't worry about this so much. And meantime, Trump closed down the travel from China. And he was one of the people that didn't think it was such a great idea. But his popularity with the left, you know, it waxes and wanes over time and how much he butts heads with the president. If he butts heads with Trump, oh, they love him. If not, and he supports Trump, it's a problem. He recently pushed back against the Democrats' testing mantra, saying the emphasis that we've been hearing is essentially testing is everything and it isn't. Okay, so I guess the point here I'm asking you, Kath, when we look at this as a person who's living through this quarantine and all this with us, how many people is an okay number to die for us to start back up to the world? Is it 1,000 people? Is it 10,000 people? Do we think even that many people will die at this point?
I could not put an amount on somebody's life. Mm-hmm. There's other things to consider, and life is the first thing for me. So that's really one of the biggest things. I do not want anybody at risk, but I see people scared, frightened, unable to function. People having no money. I mean, just watching in the people in our circles that have lost jobs and having problems with their rent. You know, we have to look at the whole person, the whole country. We're not an isolated feature.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And just the, you know, just some of the things, thinking about all these children being home and these parents being home and this frightening, this elevating their levels of insecurity and anxiety, that can't be healthy, you know?
Nope.
So I'm not really sure. I can't put a number. It's not up to me.
Right. Well, one of the things that we're looking at here is how do you put that number? Don't we already put that number on things? We know that 30 to 80,000 people die every year from the flu. If every year we shut down from October to February, we would probably cut those numbers down, wouldn't we?
Well, exactly, yeah.
We would flatten that curve.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a lot more people that apparently are dying than this one, even though every death here is terrible. But right. If we flattened that curve, wouldn't that be the right thing to do? So when we look at this, it does come down to a bunch of numbers. And we look at it, okay, how many people, if we said 50,000 people die of the flu, right? How many people a day? And I'm going by a whole year. That's 136 people, 137 people a day die from the regular flu. Well, if we have...
Not during its season,
not
but during
through
the whole year.
If you broke it up through the whole year. If you did it through the season, it's obviously probably much higher. If you know, it's only a six-month season. So you would double that number, 270 people a day of the regular flu. And we don't seem to bat an eye at that. We just say, hey, get your flu shot. You know, wash your hands, and we go about our business.
But we never thought we'd shut down the economy. We didn't know that that was an option.
Right.
I mean, maybe we'll bring this up every year when it comes to October. Shutting down, no holidays, we're not going to have any.
And who does that help? My point being is that is this part of, and I don't want to say plot because I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but does it help someone agenda to shut the economy down and have us all slow down, the government will take care of you? Does that help anybody?
Well, I don't know if it's every Democrat. I think the Democratic swamp leadership, right? They'll do anything to stay in power. you can tell by that anybody in the swamp up there and that leadership, they're more worried about, in my opinion anyway, just from seeing the last 20 years, they're more interested in having things go their way, right, for their power. Not really looking out for the people. The people are minions. They do that to just, you know, let them eat cake, whatever they need. So I do think that there is a very distinct probability that the Democratic leadership is absolutely orchestrating this to get rid of Trump in November.
Right.
Not to see deaths, not to shut down the economy that it can't recover. Because I think they figure when they want to turn the switch back on, it'll come back on like beautiful.
Right. Under President Biden, he'll have a great economy. But unfortunately, it's not about who. And that's where I think they're goofed up with the way they look at it. It's not about the person who's in charge. It's about the policies the person has. So what they're thinking, we'll shut this down. Biden will get in. We'll stay in power. And then we'll start the economy back up. And we'll be the people having the great. But their policies will destroy that.
Now, they're the anti-life what is it?
Party.
Party, right? They're the anti-life party. But they've made this that they're pro-life for this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? They're killing 50 million babies, but now they're pro-life to save this. And I'm not saying we shouldn't save every life. I don't mean that. Right. But it's funny how they're changing their mantra, right?
Hypocrisy is one of their big things. I mean, that's it doesn't matter. Hypocrisy means nothing.
That leadership has hypocrisy. Yes. I'm not going to say about every Democrat because, you know what? I know plenty of Democrats.
And we have friends and family who are on the left and are Democrats. And we know they're good people.
So we want to definitely clarify the leadership role.
Right. Mm-hmm. So here's another statistic I heard.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at the economy, and this is why it's not a, you know, you hate people, start the economy, you don't care about them dying. When you have people out of work, at these numbers, at these levels, suicide goes way up.
Mm-hmm.
People lost everything. They can't take care of their family. They kill themselves.
They don't know
how
to come back.
That's a fact of life.
They don't know how to come back.
Number two, drug use and abuse goes way up. You destroy how many hundreds of thousands of people? We're already seeing what's going on with the opioid epidemic. Now you have people who are feeling, who are destitute. 20% unemployment is depression era unemployment. So now you look at those numbers and go, how many hundreds of people a day are going to die from that?
A consequence.
How many kids can't go to college now?
Right.
How many people's families are going to be bankrupt and they're thrown out of their homes?
Mm-hmm.
So the answer on the left is not let's start the economy up and figure this out. It's let's give you enough money to keep you happy for the time being. And we'll make the mortgage companies give you, you know, furloughs. And we'll do that doesn't really help us.
Now, I have to say this. On a lot of Facebook groups, you know, there's people constantly posting about trying to get money from their unemployment and whatever. I don't know if this is going to help people be more socialist or not, because the government is so ineffective. They have made these promises that these people are going to get unemployment. And in New Jersey, you're going to get an extra $600 this month, right? So they're putting all these plans out. Well, they can't. They're hanging up on them. They can't get through. You got to call at 2 a.m.
mm-hmm.
to stand online to get a call back. I'm just saying that the inefficiency of a government is probably going to be a backfiring.
Which is, that's where a lot of people have said this. If you thought you might want to go for socialism, take a look.
Mm-hmm.
You're waiting in line for toilet paper. There's no toilet paper. Isn't that a classic thing? There's no toilet paper. There's no food. Well, guess what? We got no toilet paper and no food.
And instead of blaming it on the government, they're blaming it on Trump.
Right.
But however, if we just could get this group of people that think socialism might be an option, if we can get them to look and say, you know, it's government's inefficiency. Well, that's what Ronald Reagan said all the time about, you know, it was government's inefficiency. We have it, the Democrat leadership, maybe all leadership in the country, have made it be the other parties the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Ronald Reagan was about it was the government was the problem.
Right.
See?
Absolutely.
And now we're like, oh, it's the Democrats are the problem and it's the Republicans are the problem. And I think
government.
Maybe we need to say it's government, right?
Right. Yeah, I think you're onto something here. Now, it's hard, like you said, you can't put a number on it, but there already is a number. How many people die in car crashes a year?
I couldn't tell you.
Between 35 and 50,000 people a year that we know every single year are going to die in car crashes. Not DWI, to car crashes. Well, why don't we get rid of cars? There's 50,000 people going to die. It could be you, me, one of our kids. Why don't we get rid of cars? We know it's going to happen.
And you know what? Its speed limit is one of the biggest causes of death in a car crash.
So every speed limit should be 12 miles an hour.
Right. We should have to go Yeah, 15 miles an hour. Right. That's it. Because that would actually save all those lives. If it's about saving lives, we would be doing it in all those areas. Brilliant.
Right. So that's my point. We make choices already every single day. Now, I'm not saying that if it's 1,000 deaths more a year of people, if we start up this up again, I hope it's not me, you, anybody we know, anybody who's listening to Chasing Justice. But the reality is, people are going to die in a car accident tomorrow. We're not taking the cars away. Airplanes crash. We don't take airplanes away. We get 50 to 1,000 people a year die of the regular flu. We don't shut down. Why is this right now? And I get the beginning. Mm-hmm. Everyone, every politician, including Trump, was listening to the experts who were panicking in the news, saying a million people. Your father, who's 87 years old, was running around telling us a million people are going to die. A million. Mm-hmm. If a million people died and you didn't shut the country down, you would have to take that to your grave. And I don't mean somebody would kill you. I mean, you'd have to go, oh my God, I killed
your
a million people.
Right.
So I think all the politicians jumped on board, shut it down, shut it down, shut it down. Now we're seeing that curve flatten. Now we're in a much more, and I use this selectively, reasonable pattern where if we go back to work, yeah, some people might get sick and die from this. But we're seeing that it's really our older people and people with compromised systems. So maybe those people should be quarantined and the rest of us can go back to work.
Yeah, you don't know who has an underlying problem. Pretty much. There's a lot of young people that have died from it that we didn't know had that underlying problem.
Right.
You also brought up the thing is, why isn't there massive testing against cancer so we could catch it in the early stages so that people wouldn't die from cancer? There's a lot of things we could do, but we don't.
Right.
I do think, I have to say, that this this caucus that they have.
I want to ask you about that.
Yeah.
I heard about this caucus where it's Republicans, Democrats coming together to try and come up with a checklist or some way to get us out of this and get back to work. What did you find out?
They're called the Problem Solvers Caucus.
Problem Solvers Caucus.
And they've been around for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. And they have we have a Josh Gottheimer from New Jersey. Mm-hmm. He's a Democrat. And we have a Tom Reed from New York, a Republican.
And how many people are on that?
And they are the co-chairs. And there are, in addition to them, there's 24 Democrats and 24 Republicans.
So 50 of them all together. Okay.
Right. And they started this. They actually wear purple ties. You know when they have the red and blue ties?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
These guys wear purple ties.
Ah, they're right down the middle, trying to do the right thing.
No, actually, they're for the people. They're not down the middle. They're not saying, they are not against either party. They're saying we can have civility in our debates. We're here to work for the people.
Okay.
Our people want something, and all this fighting and bickering and is not helpful.
We all say that, right? That's what we want. Let's get along and figure this out, right?
So they delivered what they want the White House and Congress to look at, the Congress leadership, right? They wanted points for coming back. All right, what they want.
A checklist kind of a thing?
Yeah, that's it, a checklist.
They want a checklist for coming
back. So I didn't write all these words down in my notes. Okay, so first thing they want is a rapid mass COVID-19 testing. They want to be able to do it faster, and they want to do more. Right now we're doing 150K a day.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to bring it up to 750K a day. So I guess they're
saying... That's a lot, 750,000 tests a day.
We can't reopen till we can do that, which I think that's huge number. Okay.
Okay.
They also want a tracing database. Like the country tracks measles now, outbreaks. They want a better tracing database so they can see where hotspots are, so we can predict where it's going to come from.
Okay.
This one's crazy. This one, I'm totally, my mouth is hanging open on this one. Masks for every teacher and student for them to go back to school.
Now, I've heard people talk about that when they go back, we should take more of these precautions. Now, you know what's funny? I have to say, I don't know if anybody else has ever noticed it, but when we would see pictures of news items or what if something's going on somewhere in Asia, in the Koreas, Japan, or China, you'd see people all the time wearing masks.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, well, why are they wearing masks? You walk around New York City and you'll see a lot of Asian people with masks on, even before this pandemic. And you'd say, what's up with that? Because I guess culturally, they might have been hit with these kind of things in the past, and you just stay safe by putting a mask on. That's a smart thing to do.
But here's the problem. First of all, the mask, I have it, wear it on my face when I go out. I'm touching my hair, face more. I'm trying to rub my face. My nose is itchy. My breath is sweaty. I can't stand it. Can you see children in a classroom not being able to hear a teacher?
They're going
to
take it off.
Never mind the anxiety that these kids are. We're going back to school. We're going to die, Mom. Don't make me go. You know?
Right. Absolutely.
Okay. All right. They want a better supply chain for PPE.
Okay.
Right? So
personal protective equipment.
Right.
Is PPE.
So that they want that to ramp up so people can be protected, which I think in the front line you should have. They want to reconfigure business layouts so that people can have social distancing. And I thought that was a little bizarre if it's really
That's a big hand of government stepping into a business and saying, hey, you will regulate. You will have this on the... If you have one more person in that line, what are they going to do? They're going to come in and fine you because that's the way to get money.
Could you see that at Christmas time? And, of course. Kohl's and Macy's, you know,
Would it be nice if people voluntarily did that? I don't know if I like the hand of government coming in and telling business those kind of
things. And you know what's going to happen is people aren't going to go shopping. So this retail establishments, you're going to start to have that. They're going to be, all you're going to do is tell them that they're going to, you're not safe. You're just going to reinforce that they're not safe.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to stop people from going out. It's going to be more online.
So I'm going to tell you, I think we need to look this thing up because this is coming out. They're going to come out with their checklist. They're going to tell us all about this checklist and some of it's going to take. What I think, you know, who was it? One of the famous people on the left there. The mayor of Chicago, I can't think of his name, friend of the Clintons, he came out and said, hey, never let a good crisis go to waste. You can get a lot of things done you couldn't normally do.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're seeing that. We're seeing that with the first bill that was here, the stimulus bill to help Americans, our friends on the left were throwing in, hey, everyone's legal. All the illegals now become legal. We want to have, the court systems change. We want to do 25 other things that they could never get done any other time.
Right.
But now's the moment that they can stick it in there and get it in there. And why not clean bills? Why wouldn't you just come up with a bill? We need to help the American people. Here's $1 trillion. Make sure we take care of what we're taking care of. Why do we allow them to do that? Well, that's one of the bigger questions that as we go along, we have to answer as a people. You know, what are our government people really doing? Kathy, you brought it up before. Government is the worst thing of all for anything. They can't run anything except really the military.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only thing they can really run. They screw up everything else. You know, how come, and I was saying this in segment one, they know they can take your money through taxes. We can all file online and they make sure if you didn't file in the right time, they're getting you.
Mm-hmm.
But why can't they just look at that same data and go, oh, Kathy and Joe, send them their check. Hit a button and out it goes, right? We're all electronic. There's something to all of this, and you know, I got to thank you for coming on. I appreciate you looking that up. That was excellent.
There's a lot more on there.
I know, I can imagine.
Maybe we'll get to another time, but people should look it up and see.
Yes.
And I really do like the idea of this problem solvers caucus.
I do too.
I think we should all look into that and follow it because it's the model. They said we want to lead by example of how our leadership can actually function.
That would be different if people actually did the right thing. That and term limits and would be in a much better place. So listen, everybody, coming to you again from quarantine here, John Sahatchin, he told us all about the first responders. When you see your cops, your firemen, your nurses, your doctors, the people in the food stores, say thank you. Thank you for they're out there on the front line. They're doing their job so that we can all live through this. Okay? Remember, be a part of the solution, not a part of the problem. This is Lieutenant Joe Pangaro for Chasing Justice here on the America Out Loud Radio Network.